Listening to Lead Stories. That was Peter Tosh, the reggae great with Equal Rights. And it's the title, by the way, of his 1977 album, an acclaimed album. And this particular song I happen to like, Equal Rights. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And we get closer and closer to the midterm elections. And as you know, the midterm elections are carrying with it a very interesting, a plethora, I should say, of political issues being masked as something else. But we know what they are. And the top of the list, I would think, is immigration. Today, more than 7,500, an estimated 7,500 people coursing their way from Central and South America toward the U.S. border continue their trail, except that Donald Trump has seized upon this issue, not just the march of the migrants, as it's called, but has seized the issue of immigrants' rights and immigration generally as a central part of building and maintaining his political base. And we're going to be talking about that today. It has come to be a central issue in national politics and a dog whistle signal to man the ramparts against further racial decimation of America. It is, in fact, at the heart of what President Donald Trump says will make America great again if we get this thing under control. So this is why we will study. We're in study session, we're in class, learning from each other. And what I want us to do today, to make a very strong effort to give your most considered thoughts and opinions about this matter as you observe it unfolding in the United States. How has immigration, and especially the migration of people of color, but principally from Central and South America, how is this all playing into our national psyche and politics? What are we to make of immigration? In what ways has President Trump used this issue to great advantage, to strategic advantage? What do you hear from the other side of the fence, if we're hearing anything at all? We're not hearing very much from the Democrats. We're not hearing very much from other parties. But certainly the Democratic Party, we could counter pose with the Republican Party as the two sides of the same disappointing coin. What is this thing? Why now do we hear so much about immigration? The president wants to close the borders. He can't do that without congressional approval. He wants to cut aid to such countries as El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala. He can't do that. Again, congressional approval is needed for that. He wants to declare a state of emergency, a military state of emergency, if you will, so that military personnel can be stationed along the southern border. And for that, he will have to prove that the country is in imminent danger of attack. I don't know that he could make a case about that. Just so you know, back in April, a caravan of about 1,500 had reached the US-Mexico border. And just to take an example, just to use an illustration of the administration's attitudes toward migration and immigration, only 250 still await a hearing on the application for asylum. And only three so far have actually been granted asylum. So if we look at the sheer volume of people coming toward the US-Mexico border on this very issue of asylum, we can forecast that this is going to be a very long process, and the administration has no incentive to make it easy. So let's hear what you're thinking about the ways in which immigration or migration is being used by this administration to score political points and other points as well. You may want to talk about that. 888-874-4888 is the number to call. 888-874-4888. This is a very important subject. It's not going to go away anytime soon. And it has multiple implications. It's not one of those things that's just this or just that. It's not just immigration. It is a lot of things wrapped up into the discussion. But you will tell us about that when you call in at 888-874-4888. As you know, I too am an immigrant. I have particular feelings about that. And I see immigration in the context of history. And it is an unavoidable history. It is not necessarily a good history or a joyful history. It is riddled with many negative things in which people who come from these countries, such as I, come also aware that this is a struggle for survival. This is part of the struggle for survival. You're living in a country minding your own business. You have your hopes and dreams and aspirations like anybody in any country. And yet, you become increasingly aware as you grow up that the things that you want to do, you will not be able to do. You will not be able to achieve these things because prior to your dreaming, hundreds of years, hundreds and hundreds of years, have gone into manufacturing a reality for somebody else, making their dreams come true and necessitating that your dreams don't stand a chance. It's hard to explain this. Muhammad from New York, perhaps you can help us understand. What are your views on the current hot topic of immigration and migration?
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Eutrice, I sincerely wish that your health continues to improve.
And thank you.
You're very welcome. And just to address the issue about the people coming from Honduras, I think it's very important that we not just say Trump, Obama, Clinton, but whoever's behind those people, because Mr. Obama, during his tenure, and Hillary Clinton, they overthrew the duly elected president, democratically elected president, and that caused the crisis, you know. So, and it's, we can put the blame on Obama, we can say Trump, but I think as a people, as a people in this nation, we need to start looking at those people behind the scenes that's giving Obama and Clinton and Trump their agenda. Just for example, we know that Trump is heavily influenced by the neocons. And so that's what we really, as a people, that's who we need to address. And not those front men like, say, the Hillarys, the Bills, the Obamas, and the Trumps. It's the people behind them, you know. And it's time that the American people in the world really, I think the rest of the world see it. It's just us here. Thank you very much for hearing my commentary. I appreciate it.
Okay, but before you go, tell me what your own perception is.
Could you repeat that, please?
Tell me what your own, your very own personal perception of it is.
You know, after they overthrew Zelaya, then the oligarchs down there took over. And when they come in and take over, it just put all the resources, the wealth, at the top, and you leave the bottom, the people at the bottom, and not that they're poor people, they are talented, gifted, and rich, but they take away all the resources they have to develop their talents and gifts and skills. And what that does is impoverish them, and they're forced to come together. And they know where the source of the problem is. You know, now it's difficult for jobs down there. It's difficult for people to live. So they come up here, and I'm going to say this, Eutrice, people don't, unconsciously, they don't know that. But America and the West have stole all the wealth from these countries they call third world. And the people think they're coming for a job, but unconsciously they come in here to take back what we have taken away from them.
Or just coming to proceed with life the best way they can to survive. Now, you'd be surprised to know, for example, a small country like Barbados, which falls into the category that you just described, all these different countries for centuries plundering this tiny little island. Barbados has one of the highest literacy rates in the world. Little Barbados. So that it's workforce is far better educated than most major countries. The same for Puerto Rico. People would not believe that Puerto Rico's people, the Puerto Ricans, have such a high level of educational attainment, because that's an issue for them. That's important to them, and they have succeeded in getting that done as a national priority. So we have the larger countries looking at the smaller countries with an eye toward, well, what can we snatch from them? What could we take from them and make them feel grateful about it? This is an ongoing problem for the smaller countries that are besieged by the larger ones. Thank you, Mohammed, for getting us started today. Khalil from South Carolina, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon. How are you today?
Okay, Khalil, how about you?
Great, great, great.
How has Trump used this issue so strategically and with great success?
Possibly in a number of ways. First of all, I have to agree with Muhammad. You know, a lot of times people neglect to explain why people are migrating from Central and South America here. And it's, you know, a lot of it is because of what we have done. But to answer your question, well, it fits in with his white supremacist last grasp at power for his base, the perceived power to keep, you know, brown people out. But in addition, it's kind of funny. It's a big joke because they're acquiescing to maybe loosening controls on the federal prison industrial complex so that maybe they'll be losing some bed space, but then they're gaining it back with these massive internment camps that they're building. Because we need to know who are getting these contracts. You know, this is a complicated issue. And I have to say that, let me say that this is, really disturbs me. When a lot of folks who are in favor of this family separation, they will use an argument. They'll say, well, you know, if I'm here and I'm driving down the street and I get in trouble, they take my children away. And that may be true, but you know where your children are because there's something called chain of custody. And it's a very simple concept. And this is why this whole family separation thing is just, it's punitive. And if you remember, Jeff Sessions and the president said, this will be a deterrent. So it's punitive. That's what that's about. So, you know, this is their goal. They're sending a message because there are plenty of people here from Ireland and different parts of Europe, but especially Ireland, you know, a lot of bartenders who are overstaying their visas, and they just get cycled through different bars throughout the Northeast and different places around the country. Because a lot of people own a lot of bars, and that's what they do. They like to have people, Irish people in Irish bars with the brogue. So, it's about race. This is what the man is running on. We heard him yesterday. He said, I'm a nationalist, and I'm proud of it. And he said, I shouldn't say that.
He doesn't even know what a nationalist is. If you were to ask him to define nationalism, he wouldn't know what it is. But it has the word national in it, so he can feel proud of using the word. Let me ask you, why aren't we hearing a great deal of opposition, seeing a great deal of opposition from the Democrats? In line with what you just talked about, racism, one would think the Democrats would seize upon this point and drive it home. But we don't seem to be hearing much from the Democrats. Could you figure out why?
The only thing I can think of is, from what I see in my daily life, from listening and talking, is that a lot of white folks, a lot of white folks are just tired of hearing brown and black people whine and cry about how put upon they are and discrimination and prejudice, and they're tired of hearing about it. They don't care.
Okay. Is there any other reason you could think of?
You know, they're not interested. I don't know. They were looking weak. I don't know why they're anemic. And you brought that up, and that's the truth. You would think that they would be out fighting for our lives. But no, I don't know. I'm at a loss.
I'm thinking that they're going to give Trump as much rope as he wants, because this is literally on the cusp of the midterm elections. Let him run with it. Because Trump is not really appealing to people outside of what he considers to be strictly his political base. If the Democrats were to get into the fight right now, it would only add more fire to the flames that he started. So I suspect that part of their thinking is to lay low, let the midterms go ahead, let Trump keep running his mouth, because in any event, all of the things that he's threatening that he can do, he can't do without congressional approval. So that they will have their time to come back at him, but not right now. I think it's probably more a matter of timing. They don't want to give him any more, you know, any more power on this matter than he has right now. He's doing well, but he's not appealing to other people outside of his base on the issue.
No, and I'm concerned. I don't understand how his popularity is still peaking right now.
Well, it's hatred. Hatred is what is causing his popularity. And a lot of people are hateful. They love a hateful president. So he's getting that kind of energy from them. But I was wondering why the Democrats hadn't done very much of an assault. And I rethought it, and I thought maybe it was because they felt that to engage now would only give him more fire and make him more powerful in this argument. So they'll wait until perhaps the midterms are over. But still, we ought to hear something from them on this. Thanks so much, Khalil, for your call today. David from Brooklyn, how are you?
Therese, I want to approach this from a, let's say, another perspective. We have to look at the United States as a power that is primarily interested in imperialism. Now, as the chief imperial power in the world, what imperial power like the United States is interested in is getting the resources from other nations all over the world as cheaply as possible, or at perhaps no case of paying anything like in the Congo right now. In addition to that, if they have some kind of service that they can get out of the people, they'll take that too. So this is something that is objective all over the world. That means that the U.S., as it's functioning at this time and for a long time, likes places that give their resources up as cheap as possible and comply with whatever needs to be done if the population in those places have to do something. So they don't like places that don't go along with the program. So that's, I call that imperialism. Now, what I see with the caravan that's coming from Central and South America, supposedly, as Americans, many say, it's our backyard. This is, to me, a backlash. A backlash against imperialism. Those people in the country that have been successfully, from the U.S. point, raped of their resources and their people in terms of economics. This is the backlash of that policy of imperialism. So it's no surprise that you have people coming from places like Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, and many other places to escape the scourge of American imperialism. That's number one. Now, the second part of my view towards this whole situation we have now is that the way politics are played, especially here in the United States, is you have to draw attention away from the real issues. So these so-called quote-unquote immigrants, you know, are the issue. You get people's attention put upon that, and at the same time, you are doing whatever's necessary to rob the masses of people who live here. This is a place, it's like, let's say the Democrats and Republicans are two teams in the same league that is run by the ruling class. It's a ruling class that has two sports teams, and the Democrats and Republicans are in that conference or whatever you call it. So they just in the same conference and the same or same league, and the attention has to be taken away from the real issue, and the real issue is not to serve the needs of the people who live here. That is why you have a significant number of people who are broke, who have nothing, who are living in poverty in the richest country in the world. And as long as you have some scapegoats like the immigrants or a few black people or brown people or anywhere else that you can draw attention away from those things and put it on those other things, then you can maintain power. And that's what you have with the Republican and Democrat Party. And they all on the same. They have the same goal to take as much as they can from all over the world and plus the people who live here, and playing the phenotype game of different colors of people and whatnot. That's part of their game. And they know how to stay in control, and it's working very well for them.
Is this a preamble, David, to accelerated military incursion in Central and South America by the United States?
Well, it well may be. I mean, they've already threatened the progressive government of Venezuela, and we know that the business of the United States is war. You know, I mean, we have a situation where the ruling class makes things. They make military equipment. They get contracts for services. And so they are getting a big bite out of the federal budget and the tax funds that come in. And this is yum, yum. This is wonderful, because we may have a chance to, you know, even get more. And they're getting nearly $1 trillion worth of the taxes in so-called what they call defense, which is really war. And they love it. So they love war. They love to fly a F-25 airplane that costs the taxpayers $50,000 an hour, and they have other airplanes that even cost more. And, you know, I mean, when you're selling these types of things and useless things, I mean, you're in Fat City. You know, it's a tremendous profit that is being made by the ruling class by going to war. They love it. And they don't have to risk anything, no danger to them, no physical danger. That's for the poor people to be in the army and get killed and whatnot, not the rich and powerful. So, you know, it's a matter of imperialism, going to war, making money, exploiting people all over the world, and getting scapegoats to get people's attention away from the things that really count here. So they don't care about the people here. This is about caring about the rich and powerful, those at the top, at the head of the ruling class.
Thank you very much, David. That was quite a class you just conducted. Thank you so much. Bill from New Jersey, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Yatrice.
Hello. How are you doing, Bill?
Good. I have a few thoughts on this issue. As far as the people's reason for leaving, which I think you were very eloquent in stating that you're in a place where you realize that the things you want to do, your hopes and dreams, there's no way to accomplish that because for hundreds of years, a system has been set up to prevent you from doing that so that someone else can realize their dreams. I find it ironic that you are describing black people in this country, the descendants of slaves, that are in exactly that situation, that for hundreds of years a system has been set up to keep us from our dreams and keep us from doing what we want to do so that someone else can realize their dreams. Yet, when you are in that situation, you have two options, either to band together to combat it or band together to leave. And black people, the descendants of slaves in this country, have done neither. We have not band together to fight it. And we have not done as the great Marcus Garvey taught us to do, to band together to leave. So it's just ironic that we are kind of looking at these people as, you know, I understand, yet we don't do likewise. And we've been in this situation longer. And the other thing is, it's a shame that these people are marching toward a lie. The global propaganda is that America is the land of opportunity, the land of milk and honey, the home of the free and the land of the brave. That's all a lie. So they're marching toward what they think is a better life, when in reality it's kind of jumping out of the frying pan and into the fire to head here. There's no better life for waiting for them at the Mexican American border. So that's a shame that they think that, well, America, you've got this horrible Trump, but you know most people in America, the Democrats, the good people, they're behind us, they're for us, and they'll welcome us in. They had a black president, and this Trump will be gone, and America will love us, when in reality the Democrats don't have any care whatsoever for those people. That's why they're silent, because the Democrats are just as racist, just as uncaring of other people as Republicans. They just put it aside whenever they need our votes. So when they need our votes, if it's politically expedient that coming out on the side of these people marching would get them votes, they would be speaking up. But if they don't think that it's going to get them votes, then they're quiet. And that's the way the Democrats always are, quiet unless it gets them elected. That's why they're quiet.
I want to ask you a question in the context of what people do, whether we like it or not, whether we approve or not, whether we think it's right or not. What people do in service of the number one imperative, which is survival. It's not
Absolutely.
A casual decision to decide, well, you know what, I'll just grab whatever I can and hit the road with these other people and hope for the best, because it isn't so much the United States, or it's not so much any Mexico or any other country, but the larger law, the higher law of international law will protect us. What do you think about that?
Well, I think what you're saying is absolutely correct. I don't get me wrong. I don't fault them for making this move.
What I'm
saying, my major point is, why aren't black people in this country making a similar move? Why are we so complacent? Our survival is on the line just as much, and we've been dealing with this longer. And we are owed something for building this country. Yet, we don't leave. Why don't we take our survival and, you know, as a priority and leave this place like they're doing. I'm saying we should do like they're doing. Leave that place that is seeking to take your children's lives and take your life and keep you from having life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which supposedly is a right in this country, which it is not. But why aren't we doing likewise? Why haven't we?
In the immediate situation, what do you expect, let's say, at the point when this caravan does, in fact, reach the Mexico-U.S. border?
I feel very bad for these people because no good will come of it. The climate in this country, the guy that's sitting in the White House, a Congress that doesn't care about these people, no good can come of it. And I hope that it doesn't come to shooting people, but I would not be surprised at all. We're talking about America here, and America doesn't have any problem with shooting brown people, not at all, especially if they're at America's so-called border, which really Mexico really should extend quite a bit up into this country. I mean, it's a fake stolen border. But anyway, I would not be surprised if this comes down to some people's deaths. And I hope it doesn't, but I wouldn't be surprised at all.
You know, one thing that struck me is that if this were the 60s or even the 80s, we would have had a corresponding march.
Yes.
That would have formed a phalanx around these marchers and saying, we are protecting their lives with ours. We understand what they're doing. And we will watch this government that it doesn't do anything untoward. But we're not saying that. Why do you think that?
I agree. And a lot of that, I believe, is one, people are so caught up in their own survival. I mean, this country is in bad shape. I mean, there's so many people living in poverty in this country. It's two countries. So there are so many people just struggling to survive. I heard a stat that 60% of people in this country, families, can't put their hands on $500 worth of savings. So paycheck to paycheck, that's if you have a job. So people are struggling so hard just to survive in this country that they really don't have the attention to put to anything out of their own children's survival and their survival. That's one. And then two, people are so caught up in this internet, wasting their time with Facebook and Instagram and all of these things, so their attention is diverted from what's real. It's bread and circus, and the circus diverts your attention from what is important, and people's attention is highly diverted from what is important.
Wow. We're getting quite a lesson here today, and I'm so thankful that our listeners are so attuned
and
that they are sharing their thoughts so freely with us today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bill, for your call today. Jeff from New Jersey, you're on the air.
How you doing, Latrice? I'm going to say that... Well, I'm doing good today. Not too angry, I see this thing as a global initiative for the oligarchy, which is one in this country to impoverish people and put them down on the put.
You just said something heavy without explaining it. A global initiative for the oligarchy. You have to break that down.
Well, I'm finna break it down now. or what it is. If you can create poverty within your country, then you bring in other people to immigrants, allow them in illegally or whatever it is. And in this country, it works like this. You know that all these corporations vote Republican because they get the tax breaks. So you know that this immigration stance by a Republican president is a false. You know, it's a lie because they're going to allow immigrants in so they can work for $8 or $10 an hour and keep the wages low all across the board. It's better to hire someone who's here illegally than it is to hire someone who is a legal resident, because then they can protest, they can strike, they have rights, so that they can raise the minimum wage, et cetera, et cetera. When you allow the immigrants in, you keep the wages low. This seems to be something on a grand scale where we bomb, where we interfere with people's elections. We allow drug cartels to run crazy in some of these countries. And I beg to differ with David. I don't think it's going to be America doing the shooting. I think, you know, it would be some of those other governments in the South doing the shooting. We would look really bad. But other than that, you see this in other places where they're bombing in the Middle East and these immigrants are coming up into, you know, Germany and Sweden and all these other places. I think that's a little bit different, but you see them being moved from their residence. One is to be able to, for the oligarchy, to be able to take over their natural resources. And the less indigenous people, the less people of a country that you have, the easier it is to walk in and put in a fascist government that will cater to the capitalistic hungers of the world. And it's not just a American thing. You know, you see this going on all over the place. Why do you think there are wars in Africa? The wars in Africa are to keep the African nations from developing to their full potential. And without developing to their full potential, they don't utilize their resources to the best of their ability. Africa is the richest continent on the earth. Why does it have the poorest power? Why is there famine in Africa? Why are people dying for not having water when there's gold, silver, platinum, uranium? Everything is in Africa. But if we keep countries at war, they never use their minds for scientific things. They never advance their society. And therefore, the European, the people from the north, can come down and exploit the resources and use it for their own, because they don't have any under their frozen tundras.
Well, you have given us a kind of overarching view. I want you to get specific to the situation at hand. How are you reading the decision by ordinary people who have borne the brunt of poverty and denial and of equal rights in their own countries and so forth, and putting literally their lives on the line in this trek toward the border under the guise that international law protects them? What would you say about the do you not see how conditions impel these people to take these drastic actions that even put their lives and the lives of those and their families, even little children, on the line? What do you say about that?
And I say is, when you back a rabbit into the corner, he's going to fight. And then people will do what is absolutely, when you take everything away, life begins to not matter. And not that it doesn't matter, but it's not the most important thing. Your principles and how you live becomes the most important thing. What you leave for your children is the most important thing. And I don't believe that when you're in a situation where, look, if you stay there, you will be killed, your wife and daughter will be taken and put into prostitution, and your sons will be killed, what is there left? March to the border. If they kill you there, at least you did it standing up and not sitting down. You understand? And I will say this about the lack of because there are people in the, there are people in Arizona and those places like that that are really fighting for immigrants' rights. But we're not going to hear about them. I think one of the things we have to really, really take an honest look at is the fact that the oligarchy, the people in charge of this country, are have also charge of the media. So anything positive or anything that will go against Donald Trump, you notice he doesn't do interviews where he takes on questions. From the media never asks him any questions. They just report. So there's really no give and take or back and forth. But you would they control the media. Therefore, you will not hear about people who stand up for immigrants' rights. There very well could be a march in California on the opposite side of the border. But we're not going to hear about it. You know, here's where we need to really, you know, put the focus on things like PRN and other social networks where we can get the news from the ground. And that's one of the things that we need to build as a people, is to get things from the ground. And, of course, in the 1960s, like you said, there would have been a counter-march. But the news would have covered it and would have given us more information on what really is going on. We don't understand what most people do not understand what we're doing in South America, causing these people to feel hopeless and causing them to feel that they need to march towards the border. And they, you know, and march towards what?
Do you think most Americans will be concerned about that if they knew? Do you think most Americans today, given that they're going through their own, we're going through our own disasters, our own catastrophes. Have those things sapped our humanity as well? That we are now focused strictly on us, on self survival, and very little else.
Yeah, I think it the conditions that we're put under here. You know, you got disasters in Florida and you know, even Puerto Rico and North and South Carolina, you know, Louisiana, Texas, they still haven't recovered from. So it is a part of our conditioning to make us not care for one another, to make us fear one another. Right? So we think someone's coming to get what we got and we don't have much, you know, and that's part of the impoverishing of the people. And part of this fear tactic is, like I said, you don't have much. You make people think they're coming to get what you got. So therefore, you never unite as an impoverished people across borders, across racial lines, across language lines. You never unite because you're fearful of the other person. But I think that Americans, given the news in the right context, and seeing what else is going on in the world, if we were really given that view of really what was going on in the world, what was going on in Yemen and so on, that nerve would be struck. That we would say, you know what? These other people got a little worse than we got. You know, or how can I help on this way? But, you know, again, it's very difficult. Like you stated, we've been put in a position where we're worried about feeding ourselves day to day. And I think that is a planned, that is actually the overall plan. If you look around the planet, how many people, how the rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer. The poor can't come together because day to day they're trying to get a piece of bread to eat. You know, let alone march. You know, so I think that if Americans, given the right context and, truth of the matter is we need to straighten out our stuff before we join coalitions. And I think that has to be, I think it has to be across the board. Everyone needs to come with their program intact and how we join each other's programs. I think that should be the overall goal, is to unite workers of the world. But we need to set up mechanisms, which we haven't done, as far as how do we go out and do the marches? How do we go out and do the protests and also maintain, you know, our health and nutrition and, you know, keep our jobs? How do we do this in shifts? How do we, you know, how do we put this all together and do it in a way that, you know, we're not crushed because, you know what, they cut off our food supply, you know, or cut off medicine, or made sure that if you're, you know, your surveillance, you know what, you're in a protest, and now you're fired from your job. So we need to figure out a way to be able to protect ourselves and help people at the same time. And you know what? And the sad part is, I think we're going to be the ones doing marching just like they're marching up from South America. Our backs are going to be against the wall. And we're going to have nothing left to lose. And that's just the way we're going to do it. Now, we can change that. Like I said, go out and join your churches and set up these things for yourself inside your communities. And, you know, make sure your communities are strong. That's the only way we can combat this overreaching government, world government, and the government of our country, is to take care of the stuff locally, from your house to your neighborhood to your city to your state. If we can do that, we build a base. Now we can combat or counteract what the federal government might do. You understand? So, you know, federal government wants fracking. We can say in our town, no fracking within these borders or close to a farm or so on and so forth, so we can protect our food and our water sources. But that's something you can do on a local level.
Well, thank you so much, Jeff. I am just blown away by the depth of understanding of the callers, and not only that, of how they see the interrelatedness of things, which is beautiful. We do have, on the face of it, it is a march. Yes, but it isn't just a march. It's about a whole bunch of other things tied into this march. And that is exquisite analysis, when you can see these things working separately and together to produce a particular result. Some people have even talked about what that inspires us to do for ourselves, to design systems, however, you know, small they may be, but small does not mean ineffective. You could have a small organization that is highly effective or uses its resources very, very strategically to achieve an objective. The bottom line is, we're watching this, and this is not policy to us, you see. This is not about policy. The United States has never really had a smart, humane policy when it comes to deciding who, quote, deserves and who does not deserve. But I go back to the idea that my parents, without having gone to college, without having a great deal of formal education or anything like that, on my 7th birthday, gave me the two things that I need to understand: a passport and a bank book. I couldn't, of course, use them immediately. I was a child of about 7. But they implanted in my brain that early in my life, and the same with all my 8 siblings, that you have to think differently because your life is different. Your life will be different living in this country. You didn't cause anything to happen. It's not your fault and so forth. But you will have to develop a consciousness that plans are being made for you. And therefore, the earlier you get hip to that, the better. Don't live in this dream world that somehow the world would be fair. It isn't fair. And the two things that they gave us were to tell us we have to be ready at any time to move. At the time, there was no conflict in the country. There was no threatened invasion or anything like that. Life was just calm and, you know, regular. But they foresaw, they were way ahead of things. And they said, you have to be prepared. You have to be prepared because the world may not be as kind to you as you would want it to be. And you will have to be prepared to make some moves on your own. And to this day, I've never forgotten that. So I thank you so much for listening and contributing so meaningfully. You know, this is a big thing to me. Really, it is a big joy to me to listen to the wisdom that is being shared on this program. And not just willingly, but you share it with the intention of lifting everybody up. It is not important whether people agree or disagree. It is important that what you offer is so genuine and well meant. And that is a gift. You can't pay for that. So I thank you so much for honoring the program by the level of discourse that you maintain. Thanks so much for joining me today. And we'll do the same tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Yeah, crying. Tell me who are